Hello and welcome to another episode of The Meaning of Life and Such. I'm your host, Haya Kamps, and I try to chip away at the question of who we are, why we're all here, and what it all means. If that sounds a little bit vague, then, well, you try coming up with a better description of what this is all about. Notes on a postcard, please. In any case, here's our new deep dive into life, the universe, and everything. Let's roll tape. Ladies and gents, welcome back to The Meaning of Life and Such. Today I'm joined by an old friend who I have known for a long-ass time, and our lives keep intersecting in really beautiful ways. I find that Michael is such a wonderful shoulder to lean on when I have big, knotty questions, and I play that role for him as well. So, Michael, what's your name, what pronouns do you use, and where in the world are you?
Hi, so I'm Michael Ampion. I'm broadcasting live here from the middle of Copenhagen, sitting just on the edge of the harbour, indoors though. And pronouns, well, kind of old school, I guess. Him, he, and so on.
I love to start these interviews with the same question for everybody, just so the listener has a little bit of a chance to understand who we are to each other. And the question is, how did we meet and what is your first memory of
me? So I think it might be almost 10 years ago. You were running a startup called Trigger Trap.
That's right.
And we ran into each other at a place up on Pentonville Road. I think it's a prison further up that road. That could have been fun. But no, it wasn't that. It was actually in the early heady days of the explosion of co-working spaces across the world. You were working there, basically running your startup, and I was helping the founder as a sort of ad hoc, at large advisor, consultant, whatever you might call it, to basically get to grips with this new way of at that time working. My first memory is a sort of super charismatic chap kind of bursting in and insane levels of energy, and then a very strong desire to change the world. And it should be said that I also at the time did a lot of time lapsing, and of course Trigger Trap was a product that was perfect for time lapsers like myself. So I was probably from the very beginning a net promoter, and in fact I still have in my kit bag one of your wired bits, so to speak. So thank you for that.
That's awesome. Yeah, I it's funny. I think you're one of the few people who is like a legitimate like coffee machine friend, like somebody who I met in an office and struck up conversations with and became friends with. I feel like that is, for as often as you see it in movies, it's actually remarkably rare for me.
Right. Okay. Interesting. The other thing that also stands back from those days was that your team put on an event, right? I think it was called Labs London.
Yeah, that's right.
A bunch of us filtered out across town and basically captured sort of London in a day, so to speak. And that still exists today if you search for it.
Yeah, totally. Well, it's funny. I mean, with my early career, I did a lot of stuff that was around creating content and that kind of stuff. And now everybody calls it content marketing, right? It has a playbook. It has a, you know, people know how to do it. But, and I'm not going to say I invented content marketing. That's insane. But I think we were one of the few people who early on really leaned on content. And things like Labs London, which I think we got 40 photographers together all in one day, sent them all to different corners of the city to shoot time lapses. And we edited it together with music. And it actually ended up getting a bunch of TV coverage because, you know, get 40 photographers together to write a visual love letter to London, of course it's going to go pretty viral.
Yeah.
And it was just such a fun thing to do because in part it is photographers doing a photography thing, but also in part, you know, it's marketing for us. But I just loved bringing people together who were like, you know what, this is a great way to spend a Saturday to go out and play with all these other photographers and shoot a bunch of time lapses. I mean, what I hadn't realized is that the post-processing would take like forever, right? But we gave ourselves 24 hours and we had like, oh God, we had, I can't remember, hundreds of thousands of still images that needed to be combined into video. It was absolutely
I definitely handed over. I'm thinking, well, several thousand for sure, right? And
yeah.
And they might not all have been at the optimal size either. Meaning, and when I say optimal size, I mean small enough to be viable in a fast-moving time lapse, right?
Yeah.
So the file sizes and at the time, of course, disk drives, processing power, and whatever else wasn't quite what it is today. So yeah, not an enviable task, but it was one that was done with a blob.
Yeah, no, it was super fun. You know, the thing I miss most about my companies in the past are the people I used to work with. I feel like Trigger Trap, you know, did it help photographers do things they couldn't otherwise do? Absolutely. And there's still a Flickr group out there that is called Ooh. Trigger Trap that has, you know, thousands and thousands of photos in it. And on Instagram occasionally, I follow the hashtag Trigger Trap tag. There's still mm-hmm. people out there shooting with it, even though the company shut down 5 years ago, right? There's wow. been no additional support. I know that one of our developers is keeping one of the apps alive. So the app still mm-hmm. exists. You can still use the equipment, but that's kind of a labor of love. You know, I think he charges yeah. like $3 for it. And whenever Apple does another update, he grunts and writes another update for the app. But it's amazing how it's taken on a life of its own. And that's not because I needed it to stay alive. I mean, I'm grateful it does, but it's the people who are like, no, this thing is interesting enough that it deserves to have a life out there, even though it's no longer actively being supported, or even though you can't actually go and buy the product anymore.
That is remarkable. And I would say really interesting in itself. Yeah, interesting. I think that will give bearing on some of the, what we'll, you know, not to jump ahead in the conversation, but I think that will serve in some ways as an interesting metaphor.
Yeah.
We'll talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is one of those things where I've now done a bunch of these interviews, and there's a trifecta of things that I get really stuck on when it comes to really big questions in life. One is, who is the I? Like, who is the me that is having this conversation, right? Who is the I that is accessing my memories, that is, you know, did the I exist before my body, and does it exist after the body? Call it a soul, call it a spirit, call it a whatever. The second piece is, you know, how do we make decisions? And to know that, you have to know what your North Star is. And I think those three things are really closely associated with what I would refer to as the meaning of life. Because ultimately, I think as humans, we kind of are our decisions, right? We have the capacity of emotions. We have the capacity of thought in ways that most animals don't. To be fair, many humans don't. And you end up in a place where you are trying to like wallow your way through this universe. But I think the question of what is the I that does the deciding and feeling is a really interesting one, because it dovetails with a bunch of these other things. Do you have any feelings about, you know, what is it inside you that makes you you?
Yeah, it's obviously a profound question, probably best suited for a kind of a late night conversation, maybe suitable.
2.5 whiskeys in a campfire.
Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. But if we were to jump in it on a rainy day and simply think about it, I think that's the initial premise that you're setting out, right? Which is that it is something that exists. And your question, did it exist before you did as a physical entity or not? Then I'm probably a little bit, how can I say it, practical in that I believe our consciousness, and it has to be a belief, at least in my book, is something that is active whilst we are. That the your perspective on life is really interesting from the point of view that we often take a position on where other people are approaching an issue based on how we see them today. But actually inside yourself, your own view of yourself might actually be a lot more timeless. So in some ways, I would say that I've changed lots of approaches to what I do and what I consider myself to be through age. And at the same time, in many ways, I and I think many other people also can see themselves as a 12-year-old, as a 9-year-old, as a 22-year-old, whatever the relevant age is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. I think for me, there is something so so interesting about grappling with the I. In that I just never can get a firm handle on it, you know? And maybe I don't need to, but I just find it such the I or the me or the soul or what have you is so slippery. Because every time I think I have a feeling for what it actually is or how to define it, I find exceptions. And it means that I don't understand yet. It's a little bit of the Zen thing, right? If you think you understand Zen Buddhism, you don't understand Zen Buddhism. And I wonder if this is it related to it. And every time I get far enough down this path, I kind of just give up. I'm like, you know what? The I can be a placeholder. I can move on to the other questions now. But as I get deep enough into the other questions, I kind of keep circling back to the I. And I'm like, no, damn it. I need to figure out who it is that's trying to figure out these questions before I can figure out the questions. And then I can try and worry about the answers kind of thing.
Right. I can almost follow you there. And I'm going to draw a parallel, actually. I recently watched, you might have seen the film Inception, right? Which works on
levels
and so on. And then I recently watched a film called Tenet by the same director. And at some point, it got so confusing that there was basically one choice, which is don't watch the rest of the movie, or simply suspend disbelief so comprehensively that you are just about trying to hold on to just recognizing the actors in the story, meaning the people, and basically trying to hang on to the story. And I think life sometimes can actually end up like that, because life is not as linear as we might think. Relationships are not linear. So there's a helpful metaphor in actually those two very different movies. One actually arguably is only about being awake, and the other one is arguably only about being asleep.
Well, and the interesting thing in both of those movies is the liminal space in between, like moving between those two worlds. Yeah.
And I think for mere mortals, you know, the average person walking down the street, you and me, whichever, half the time we just barely try to hang on to the everything that's going on. And I would also say half the time we are probably actually suspended in a moment where it doesn't really necessarily matter, right? So in Greek literature, was it Plato maybe who said out around eudaimonia, right? So the ability to live in the moment and so on, where you actually in some ways let go of yourself, you transcend, right?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, also if all the way through to probably Freud, you've got the id, or actually Jung probably more likely, the id, and then the kind of opening up around the subconscious and all the things that are influencing you there. And then you have this sort of quite brash wake up in the 21st century where we have increasing levels of data telling us, you know, what is conscious, what is unconscious, and so on.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's generally a lot going on, I think, at least for me, I think also for you. And it can be hard to make sense of it all, but it bears thinking about. And as you are suggesting, it's probably a topic we don't discuss often enough, friends in between, whether on a rainy day or indeed in the deep of night.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really fascinating. I think that the two things there. One, the feeling that these conversations are best had at night rather than the bright light of day is really pervasive. And I agree with that, but I'm curious why that is. Like, why is it only at the end of the day, as we're getting tired, maybe a couple of beers in, that we feel like we have the peace of mind to think about big questions?
Hmm. Yeah, I don't have a good answer for you apart from...
Do you have an awful one?
Well, I have a sort of an instinctive one, which is the fact that, you know, you have to overcome a certain level of letting go when it comes to really big life questions.
Yes.
And so they're often better arrived at basically when your defense mechanism is slightly reduced, right? And your defense mechanism is slightly reduced with physical exertion and with basically the end of a day or things you've imbibed or consumed that might affect you, your mind to lower barriers.
Yeah.
What I would also say is to really, really get into deep conversations with people, you also need a lot of time.
And so
it can happen at other times. For example, if you go for a very long, when I say very long, I mean ideally some hundreds of kilometers walk with somebody else, then eventually you run out of all the other things you could talk about. Do you see what I mean? And that's what it up. But it's just in normal everyday life, that doesn't necessarily happen at 11 a.m., right?
Yeah. Well, and I wonder if you know, maybe boredom fuels this, or maybe fear is like, okay, well, it's like if you, I don't know if you've ever done this, but I've had some mental health wobbles recently. And at some point I found myself saying, you know what, I'm going to clean for 2 days. I'm going to clean up my house completely for 2 days. That's like a productive thing I can do. And I started cleaning. And, you know, the first 3 hours, it's very easy. There's mess, there's rubbish, there's things laying around. The next 3 hours, you clean everything, right? There's mops, there's hoovers. And then suddenly you realize, wait a minute, I have a whole day left and everything is kind of clean.
Right.
And that's when you go, okay, fine. I'll do the inside of the fridge. I'll do behind the toilet. I do like the bits that you don't normally like really get into.
Right.
And then once those are done, that's when the meaning of life happens. You know, you're so deep into doing something that eventually you've kind of blocked out the amount of time. But it's just like this kind of desperation for, fine, I'll clean that last little part of the back of the closet that I was never going to clean. And for a lot of humans, and myself included, that is where these questions live. They are so far behind. Because I'm sure as a kid, I must have thought about this a lot. But I couldn't find any conclusions. And I kind of just went, well, I guess that's not for me. And you put it away. But of course, it bears re-examining with the context of life that's been lived in the 40 years between that, you know?
Interesting. So what you're saying is basically there is an alternative to what's known as a vision quest, which is, you know, you found a suitable mountain, you climb it alone, and ideally spend maybe weeks there, or you go into a desert, right? And you wait for inspiration to strike you. Or indeed, you go and live by Walden Pond and write a book about it afterwards. But at the core of it, you have your inspiration whilst you are at the pond, like Thoreau, right? But what you're saying is basically there is a highly accessible, available in any urban environment, or indeed suburban or rural, whenever and wherever there is a kitchen open to you and to me, is just get to it, but don't stop after an hour. Keep at it. That was not an perspective I was expecting to come across, but it is an interesting one. I have not tried this methodology myself. I have to admit, I have taken the more traditional of very long cycle, ride or walking. Yeah. For example, I did some years ago institute what I was hoping would be a tradition akin to that, which I'm sad to say that I didn't manage to keep up yet, but you know, you can always start a new tradition, so I guess I could get back to it. But the idea was to basically walk the length it takes to listen to a reading of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, because oh boy, they put life in perspective, that's for sure.
No kidding.
And so I did it once, about 25 kilometers, I guess. Basically along the Basingstoke Canal, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. I do believe that. That's actually a nice walk.
Yeah, it's a nice walk. So and I'd like to do it again. But the kitchen much more readily available. I can tell you that there is almost no house in the world that that doesn't have one. So I guess there's a call to action there. Get to it.
Yeah, totally. And I think for me in particular, there's this really interesting piece about knowing that this is available. And I think this really gels with your comment about the campfire or late at night. Right, the day is complete. Maybe it's actually tied to the whole Maslow's hierarchy of need. I mean, the conversation we're having right now is about self-actualization.
Right.
And when you're talking about Tenet and Inception, the thing that really made my spidey senses go off was the thought of, you know, a lot of people are just sailing through life. And I'm like, yeah, that includes me. Right. I've definitely been in moments of just being so poorly in my body and feeling like I have so little control over my own life. That if I make it through the end of the day and remember to eat and maybe take a shower, that was a fucking accomplishment for that day. You know, I'm like, pat myself on the back. I ate two meals. I drank enough water and I took a shower so I don't smell bad. You know what? Fuck it. This was a successful day. On those days, you're not going to go anywhere near to the id. You're not going to get a step closer to figuring out what the meaning of life is. And that is okay. And so I feel like the fact that I now feel really called to reaching into that bag and see what comes up when I grab something, it's really interesting. I am definitely on a path of self-actualization and reaching beyond. And, you know, with a lot of other stuff that's going on in my life, that's actually a little bit surprising. I'm not in the greatest of places right now, but that's okay. I feel like this is part distraction, part vision quest, part, you know, an excuse to have really big, deep conversations with friends I haven't spoken to in a while.
Right, right. I think the last bit is the most important. I think, I'm absolutely confident that with the reduction in travel, which undoubtedly is a good thing for the environment, but I think the data is clear that in the Western world, most people were struggling to maintain friendships anyway. I'm sure we can find and cite the research link later for the
for the academically inclined.
Yeah, exactly. But the core purpose is that people have been struggling to maintain friendships, especially I'm sad to say that men have been struggling to maintain friendships. And that hasn't improved with a pandemic going across the world. And generally, if the other thing I think is important and interesting is that if you did if you just wrote to somebody saying, I'd like to have a deep conversation about the meaning of life with you, you know, even your good friends probably do a double take, right?
I mean, my good friends are pretty used to weird shit from me, I'm going to be perfectly honest. But also, I mean, I reached out to you. This is the first time we've spoken in a little while. And you had the correct response, which is like, why are you talking to me? And I'll listen to an episode and see what I think.
Right.
But also, it is one of those things where my thought process was this, Michael, which was I sat down and with a piece of paper and I was like, okay, who are people who have at inflection points of my life had a disproportionate amount of impact on how I made an important decision?
Right.
And you were very near the top of that list because, you know, we have had some really big and important conversations over the years. It's not that we talk every month, but it feels like when there is like a important moment or an important decision, you're one of those mentors I turn to. And I was like, well, for this, I definitely need to talk to you. Maybe you have some directional thoughts.
Well, so I'll repay you the compliment. And I think that's actually the most misunderstood thing. So mentoring is a topic that's passionate to, or I'm passionate about. Main thing is that everybody can be a mentor. Obviously, it's a fictional character in the story of Odysseus, right? Mm-hmm. In practice, it's any person who is willing to listen carefully and give counsel to others. And the best counsel to others is if it works in both directions, right? It is very rare that good counsel is unidirectional, so to speak. So,
I had not thought about that, but you are correct. That is exceedingly rare,
right?
Huh?
Because you, I believe you need to be able to look eye to eye, right? And Yeah. So.
Well, and it's a really vulnerable and intimate thing, right? You don't need if you have a big question, it isn't necessarily that you are struggling with that question and you don't have an answer, but you need to show enough of yourself for the other person to have enough context to be able to give meaningful feedback or even ask meaningful questions, right? I think a lot of the time I turn to you not because you have the answers, but because you have the best questions.
Right, and I think you've hit the spot there, right? So basically, in a good conversation, ideally, it's a little bit like a good old Venn diagram, right? There's an intersect between basically you and me. But for a brief moment, to bring clarity to a point, we kind of need to occupy the same space, even if it is momentarily.
Yeah.
For having the same vantage point, right? So yes. Somehow, and that's back to your multi-universe, whatever, but that's kind of, you need to be able to see things the same way, even, again, if it's only for a split second, to share an understanding, and then through that, be able to see and guide, and most importantly, like you say, question. Right, it's very few people who benefit from being told what to do.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And I feel like in especially like if we're going to go bold enough to say, hey, we're going to have a real conversation about the meaning of life. And the thing is, I don't, you know, I'm a realist as well, and I realize that in this podcast series, we are not going to find the meaning of life. But what I have found, even in the first 5 or 6 episodes I've recorded, is that people have approaches to this and value sets around this that are so different from mine. And I should have known that, right? I should have seen that coming. Right. What I didn't realize was how clearly a vision a lot of people have about these questions that is so different from mine. And that makes my spidey sense super happy. I get very kind of intrigued to hear how people grapple with this. And for some people, that's a religious thing. For some people, that's a community thing, or like, and honestly, I get the impression that some people just haven't really spent any time thinking about it at all, and that's fine.
Right.
But it's the process of getting there that I find really juicy and really interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I also really enjoy hearing, especially people sharing, in some cases, very practical approaches, right, on how they deal with something. Because one of the ways you humans solve problems is basically hearing about how other people overcome problems. We are capable of overlaying our own challenges, right?
Yeah.
And that's also why, again, the research is strong that people who read fiction, and by the way, I would like to spend more time, I should read more fiction than certainly I do today, but it's a way of training your brain to think in different dimensions, which you might not get from so many other activities. And the same can be said of the stories that you hear from people, except in that case it might not be fiction, it might be real, right? But it's still the ability to imagine and see another world, yeah?
We see this in the business world a lot, right? Frameworks are really important tools for helping think through challenges, right? It could be as simple as a SWOT analysis, could be much, much more complicated, as they love shoving down your throat in business school. But they don't give you the answers. They give you the frameworks and the processes, right?
Right.
The ability of being able to Google something is much more important than the ability of knowing all the information in the known universe.
Right.
And I think that is actually what this is. This is a meta conversation about how to think about these things, which means that it's applicable to other people's lives too. And I feel like hearing different frameworks and hearing different approaches is really what this is about.
I would agree. I think the accumulation of different approaches makes for a richer library, right? And to express your sentiment around Googling, you could say it a different way, that it's not knowing what's in the books, it's knowing where to find them.
Right? Yes. Yeah, and I guess having enough general knowledge to know what to Google for. I have occasionally stumbled into brand new communities and universes where I wouldn't have the first idea what to even Google, right? You need a basic vocabulary to know what the different things are you are looking for.
Right.
And then from there, it's like that learning a new language thing, right? The day you pick up a thesaurus instead of a dictionary is when you know the language.
Right. Good point. Good point.
Yeah. And so I'm curious then, Michael, you've done some really fun thing professionally. You just became a father relatively recently. And it feels like you, more than most people I know, have a pretty clear guiding star for how you live your life. And you're much more strategic than most people I know about how to approach these big questions. Do you know what you did to get there? Like, what is your North Star? What is your purpose in life?
Well, good question. There was quite a lot of questions there all bundled together, right? So what is your North Star? And what is your purpose? So a purpose in life, I guess, would be to leave the world a better place than one found it, right? Which hopefully is not an arrogant statement, but rather a statement of actually utility to it in an extent, right? Of how can you be of service to others? How can you help others? And ultimately, you could say that ties into a very simple, even though I'm not a Buddhist, but kind of the principle of karma, right? That actually ties into what is in most of the great faiths, at least by follower numbers. There might be smaller faiths that are also great, don't get me wrong, but it's the golden rule, right? So do unto others as you wish they would do unto you, and so on.
Yes.
So in really plain everyday language on a rainy day, it's basically be helpful, right? That can also be dangerous though, right? So that means, I think it's Adam Grant, he's a professor, a psychologist and so on, who's done some research or probably meta research, meaning he's looked at lots of other studies and then had done his own around givers and takers, and there are different personality types and so on. And if you're a person who's generally looking to be helpful, then you sometimes fall into a trap of not helping yourself, right?
Yeah.
So there can be some pitfalls there. With regards to the guiding star, and then the point about being strategic, I think it's mainly about clarity, right? So it's using really, really short questions, because it's very hard to hide from very, very short open questions, right? So things like, what does success look like, right? And if you think of those few words, they can hold multiverses in them, of feeling, well, emotion, right? In all the way down to super practical clarity around X, Y, and Z, whatever it might be, right? If we use a mountaineer as an example, right? So what does success look like? Well, it might be, to climb the mountain, but that's too simplistic, right? It might also be to go on a walk that is long enough to get tired enough to have the good conversations with the people you're walking with.
Yeah.
It might be to walk high enough to be able to see the sky in a new way because it's clearer at an altitude. So it's about thinking about the richness of what it is that you want to do,
yeah,
and where you want to get to, and then I think a very important element that took me some time to understand, in fact, two principles. One, compounding interest. I definitely learned about it in school, and I think you probably did too. But it
yep.
took me a surprising amount of extra time to really understand the value of compounding interest. And I'm not talking about financials here. I'm talking about the compounding interest of investing, for example, in skill, in relationships, in lots of other things where a little done every day really adds up over time, right? I think the other principle I completely lost. There you go.
I mean, I think the It's fascinating. The do unto others actually came up in another interview I did recently. And I spent a lot of time meditating on that when that came up, because I was like, okay, I've heard of the golden rule often enough that clearly this is something that matters, but it never really connected with me until in my research, I read somebody reframe it, which was, would you be okay if everybody in your city does what you're about to do right now?
Right.
And it is the same question, right? It is do unto others. But what really landed on me there is that this is a thing about the tragedy of the commons. This is a thing about, privilege, essentially. Like, do unto others. If I buy myself a fancy car that pollutes a lot,
right?
I mean, I might like that car, right? And right. There's no do unto others in there unless you take a couple of steps further and go, wait a minute, I could be driving something that is a lot more modest, that has a lot less of an impact. And if everybody drove around in this stupid Chevy Corvette, that would not be a good thing. And I think taking the do unto others and overlaying that with a community or a societal question, for me, hits home a lot harder, because it means it kind of takes away the selfishness element of what I'm about to do. Can I, right. Like, will the world end if I drop a piece of chewing gum on the ground? No. Will right. the world end if, you know, the 22 million people who live in my city drop chewing gum on the ground? Yes.
Right.
And I think that little twist to that same statement made the same statement have a much bigger impact on me. And I'm wondering how many other sayings or things like that I have missed because I didn't fully internalize what they actually mean in the grander context.
Right. I think it's an interesting point. And I would add that there's also a risk in it, right? There's sort of two extremes. One, there's a branch of Buddhism, right, which is basically all the way through to do no harm of any kind, right? Which makes for a very difficult living. Because if you are cycling, which is a low carbon activity, even on a carbon fiber bicycle, right? Or relatively low carbon.
I see what you did there.
And if you then unfortunately, cycle into a swarm of what's it called, or butterflies or whatever else, you risk still hitting and harming one of the butterflies. If we were to make it a beautiful image, you can think of other flying objects, right, and so on. So it can make life quite difficult. You could run over a rainworm or whatever else, right? That said, the other corner of a potential triangle there is around saying, okay, I might not go to the extreme of do no harm at all, simply because life would be almost impossible to live except for certain select monasteries in the Nepalese highlands or the foothills of the Himalayas, right? The other angle might be to say, okay, well, it's all the environmental impact and everything else is down to me. And it is, but it's also a lot down to regulation and other structures around us, right?
Yes.
So the availability. So not to pick on Humvee, but let's pick on Humvee, a vehicle arguably designed for warfare, had a brief time as a popular vehicle for transport in some countries, despite it not actually necessarily being that comfortable to drive in.
Yeah.
But certainly very large and imposing and some would say intimidating. And part of what is worth building into that is the fact that society does also, and we also have the ability to do, I think, what is called choice editing, right? So actually not making the choices available to us at all. So I think there's an interplay between three different corners there, right? Of do no harm at all, do harm that you are aware of and try and minimize it. And then the interplay with the outside world of basically, okay, what is even available without constraining what we might consider a certain level of freedom of choice.
Yeah. Well, and what comes up for me when you say that is the, like, do no harm is unrealistic, right? If that is your ultimate goal, then, you know, take your own life. There is no way of living completely without doing harm. But you can optimize for doing minimal harm.
Yeah, and then it would be a miss as a, I don't often speak about this, but I was once upon a time a Samaritan. It's a role you train quite intensively for. It's basically a line that you can call in the UK if you feel distressed. My first thing is, of course, if you're hearing this conversation, you're feeling distressed, then do speak to another human being, including, you could, of course, call the Samaritans. There will be other local equivalents available and so on. And then I would quickly stress that even if hypothetically we all killed ourselves, so to speak, then that actually wouldn't necessarily fall within do no harm, because it would have an impact on others.
So what you're saying is that if everybody takes the same action, then this is not the do unto others that we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, or even if one person does it, right? So yes. If somebody takes their own life, they can leave a hole in the universe, to put it at a grand scale, right? So it's not an insignificant thing, right? And even if we just take it back to the broader level of nature, right? So the average hawk would struggle if it didn't catch a fly, right? Or whatever, probably a sparrow hawk would go for, and so on. So nature itself isn't based on do no harm. So there's an interest in minimizing, and then because we're humans, there's an interest, I think, or an interesting intersect between us minimizing and controlling ourselves, and then us helping create a system that helps us all look after each other. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, Michael. And I think this is one of the interesting reasons why I chose you. I didn't know that you'd been a Samaritan, but I very much welcome the challenge to me so flippantly saying, kill yourself. And I think that is one of the interesting pieces about you, is that you sometimes pick out something where you go, wait a minute, no. There is something that needs to kind of be thought about there. And I also like how kindly you did that. That wasn't a correction. That was an invitation to rethink.
Right.
And I think that is a really powerful thing that you in particular have, but that great mentors have in general. And it kind of goes to the do as little harm as you can, right? I don't generally advise suicide. That seems like not a good idea. Yeah. And even flippantly, that is not something that makes sense. Because as you hinted at, somebody listening to this may be in a mind space where that actually sounds like a great idea, especially if you're thinking about the meaning of life.
Right.
And yeah, no, I welcome that correction. And where my mind goes is it's about the piece of doing as little harm as possible. You know, taking one's own life is not unharmful. And so, you know, staying alive or building a life, like if you decide I want to leave this planet better than I found it, which is where we started this conversation, taking the life force you have and pouring it into that as a challenge is a powerful way of doing that. And that could mean in small ways, i.e. clean up the litter at the side of the roads near where you live, right? That's something that's within most people's reach. Right. Or, you know, become Greta Thunberg and really go for it. But the scale isn't important. It's the importance is you can do 1% better than the people around you.
Oh, for sure. And many of us have arguably more power than we probably realize, right? If we were willing to again, back to not argue with other people, because that doesn't necessarily lead to a productive outcome, but ask some open questions of our friends, colleagues, and whatever else around assumptions of what we all do. Anything from, don't tell people what car to buy. I don't think they will necessarily appreciate that, but one can always ask, have you thought about something else, right? Or what other options are available? And make it into a shared exploration, because the other thing is that the person who has a fixed idea on something particular might know something that you don't know, and they might invite you into understanding for a brief moment what it's like to stand in their shoes and the challenges that they have. And that might open up new insights for both of you, I would say.
That feels so right. That feels so right. I mean, that's
And yeah, I just want to add quickly that we're all human as well, right? So we will all at some point inevitably give people advice that they didn't want. We will inevitably, yeah. Fall through all sorts of holes in this. So what I'm expressing is an aspirational thing that certainly I would hope to be able to live up to, but I would make no claim that I do on an everyday basis necessarily, right?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a part of the whole nonviolent communication ethos, right? Asking somebody like, hey, are you open to some feedback?
Right.
And if they are not, let them say no and celebrate that no. It's like, you know what? No, I'm in the middle of the process here. I was glad to share a draft with you, but I don't need feedback right now. That is not going to be helpful.
Right.
And knowing that in your heart of hearts, and the other person, even though they might have feedback that is super valuable, you have to be in the right state of mind to receive that.
Right. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you think of a moment where there was this inflection point in your life where something really big shifted for you? Like, where your kind of meaning of life or your directionality went, wait a minute, and took a significant turn?
I think several different times. I would say that if I was to, you're hinting at a specific moment right in time.
I know a few in your life, so I was wondering if you were, if there was one that sprung out at you as like a big shift.
One that sort of that comes to mind, right? At the time, this was before you and I met, I had been working for an organization for quite some years, and it was the kind of place where it wasn't unusual that people would work their whole life, basically, and quite often happily so, and then retire and the rest is history. I basically was taking a train into London, and as I walked through the doors of the train carriage onto Waterloo Station, I just suddenly went like, okay, I think I need to do something different. And it wasn't that I was going to go in and actually leave. What I initially thought, okay, I need to explore something different. So I decided to take a year off and basically hitchhike through most of West Africa.
Nice.
Was it a impulsive decision? No, it's probably something that I had mulled on. It was something I mulled for years and wanted to do, but it came at me as at a sort of like, okay, now I need to do something. And I did. And I think we all, even if we do decisions like that, we've done them in the past, we might eventually all become a little bit more complacent with time. And I'm not suggesting anybody should run off into the sunset and do anything necessarily, but I think that it's important to hold on to the willingness to go and explore things. And by the way, you don't necessarily have to go hitchhiking. It could just be to explore a new part of the town you live in or whatever else. But just to get out of that everyday routine, right?
I connect so strongly with that because I recently did have a big moment like that, right? I went through a divorce, and all the steps leading up to that were very, very complex and complicated and painful. And, you know, it's a little bit like, this is going to be painful. It's going to be excruciatingly painful. And what happens at the end of that hopefully is worth it, right? It would have been so much easier to stay. It would have been so much easier to find ways of making it work. Although the thing for me was like, we found a couple of things where, I mean, my flippant comment about suicide earlier, notwithstanding, this was a very serious moment in my life that I'm still grieving quite heavily, right? There was a death there. There was a death of a relationship.
Right.
And now I'm starting to come out the other side and I'm starting to see color again. I'm starting to feel like, oh, yes, maybe that decision was the right decision. I have been in such a deep state of doubt for so long about this that now starting to see a little bit of like, oh, wait, there's some opportunity or there's some possibility on the horizon again. That is quite something.
That is quite something. And I would hasten on to add on to it. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that people shouldn't think about the end of life, because it is a way of focusing your mind, right? In the same way as thinking of the end of a relationship, I find also focuses. And by the way, it would be unnatural if we went through life without ending some relationships, whether it's school friends you drift away from or family members who were born long before you were. They inevitably, if nature has its natural order, they will pass away before you and I do, right? And so on. But there's also sort of a, you know, hold on tightly, let go lightly principle, right? That,
yes.
That there is a time to let go of things. That's for sure. That also calls for a kind of, without going all governance language for you here, but at board level, you talk about risk appetite, right? So to an extent, tying back to your question around being strategic, right? It's to an extent clarifying to yourself, what is my risk appetite? What am I willing to put into play? Right. And that inevitably changes with age, but it is quite common that most of us become a little bit more careful with age, right? I'm slightly less likely to long for the foothills of Himalaya, at least without an oxygen mask, right?
Well, it's a little bit the size of your stash, right? It is like if you have $1 million, you know, walking into a casino and putting it on black is one thing. But you often have the moment of like the concept where somebody says, I have nothing left to lose.
Right.
Right. My life has gotten to a place now where I have to take some sort of an action. And at that point, you know, if you have $2, you're like, well, you know what? I can't really do anything with $2. Let's stick it on black. If I turn it into $4, great. And if it goes away, whatever, I'll shrug and walk out of this casino.
Right.
And I feel like that is kind of the equivalent of a lot of these choices. Like, you know, the stash you have, that could be relationships, that could be your job, that could be your career, that could be any number of things in your life that you are willing to bet. And I think I'm just repeating back to you what you were just saying, so maybe it's a little bit mansplaining here, but that feels really deep and real to me.
Yeah, and to add a layer to it, I think tying back to what we were talking earlier about with regards to giving and taking and whatever else, right? And then you're talking about the I, but another really important thing is the we, right? The we is the intersect between two people or maybe in some cases many, many people, right? And one of the points of clarity there is are both people putting an equivalent amount in willingly and freely? That's important, right? And sometimes you find that maybe you are investing too much, or maybe they are investing too much, and the match just isn't there for whatever reason anymore, and that's okay. Then it might be a time for a timeout, right? What I would say though is that I have absolutely no doubt that it's the people who can maintain lifelong relationships, maintaining what is known as the, I think it's the happiness quota or something like that. And the happiness quota specifically is from a research project, ultimately about married people, but I think it's true for all relationships, which is that you probably need about 5 positive interactions for every bad one. That feels like an appropriate one, right? So the only exception might be, you know, I don't know, certain type of restaurant where you don't mind the waiter being very rude to you every time because the food is so amazing, right?
Right. Yeah. But
apart from that one exception, generally you're looking for mostly positive interactions versus negative ones, right?
Yeah. Mate, I could talk to you about this all fucking day. We've been talking for an hour, and I'm trying to keep these to under an hour.
Yes.
And there were like a million topics we went nowhere near. And I have so many loose threads I'd love to pull on. So perhaps we have to do a part two of this at some point. But where I wanted to close on was, do you have like a phrase or a mantra or something that you dip into when the going gets tough? Like when you have like a really difficult challenge or a hard day, do you have something you turn to remind yourself what your North Star is?
I don't have a definitive mantra apart from thinking around, I guess, what you call good karma or the old Churchill, bizarre individual as he was in many ways. But there's an old saying, which is, if you're going through hell, keep going, right? But I think it's more a stance. So it's doing my best to have an open hand and an open heart. And for that to really work, you kind of have to introduce your head as well, right? So it's head, hand, and heart ultimately. So basically, does it make sense? Is it practical? And does it feel right? And I think if I was tied back to your kitchen vision quest, if I can call it that, which you might want to trademark and develop, then basically the practical, sometimes when we despair, it's because we've lost sense or a feeling of the practical, right? And so there's good advice there from Kierkegaard. I'm not going to quote it in full, but if you search for Kierkegaard and the value of walking, then he has some words for you. Mm. And then there's an old saying from Seneca, right? So to bear trials with a calm mind robs misfortune of its strength and burden.
Mm.
Probably originally expressed in Latin, but nevertheless. And that comes back to the kind of, as you try and calm the head and calm the heart, sometimes you have to use your hands in very practical sense.
Right? Yes.
Oh,
that's so good.
Right?
Friend, this was every bit as wonderful as I knew it was going to be. Thank you.
Well, likewise, thank you. This was interesting and wide-ranging, to say the least.
Yes. thanks.